Friday, February 25th, was a good day from beginning to end. Up early, 7 o'clock, coffee and juice, and then off at 8 with Liz in my straw bag. They always accompany me for one of the many trips that have been such vivid parts of my time in the White House. This one was to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, to address a leadership conference of women sponsored by the American Association of University Women and the Alabama Federation of Business and Professional Women's Clubs, and the Alabama Federation of Women's Clubs, and the League of Women Voters, taking place at the university, and to a considerable degree, I expect, aided and abetted by Dr. Frank Rose. The setting of the trip was not without its drama. Tuscaloosa is the hometown of the Imperial Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, Mr. Robert Shelton, and he had issued some sort of statement complaining about the University of Alabama allowing such pink-coat tripe as my speech on the campus. And I was also coming about a day after the announcement that Mrs. George Wallace was going to run to succeed her husband. I've had a few kind words to say about women taking an active part in citizenship in government, and I knew the newspaper women would light on this like a duck on a June bug. The answer simply that I never take part in Democratic primaries. So if the stage was set for drama for the newspaper people, merely because it was going into the South by the wife of a liberal president, who herself has ties there, day was only set for prospects of delight for me, and I was right. It began with beautiful sunshine and was filled with warmth and interest and happiness all day through. This time we had a chartered plane full of newspaper women, Frances Lewin and Helen Thomas, the regulars, Winzola McClendon, Jim Free of the Birmingham News, our only man, except for some cameramen, and another southerner, Margaret Shannon of the Atlanta Constitution, three members of the radio TV media, Faye Wells and Barbara Coleman and Betty Lee Hansen, Norma Milligan of Newsweek, two from USIA, Josephine Ripley of the Christian Science Monitor, and Isabel Shelton and Nan Robertson, one of the most attractive of them all. Sometimes I think I spend more time with and know best newspaper women than anybody in town, and mostly I like them. Between hot rolls and coffee, I did an interview with Betty Lee Hansen on tape, reviewed all the events of the day with Liz, and read my speech. Then, at 11 o'clock, we arrived at the Tuscaloosa Airport. There was tall, handsome Dr. Frank Rose and his wife to meet me. The mayor of Tuscaloosa, Mr. Von Tassel, his wife, with a lovely bouquet of charmingly arranged spring flowers, and Mayor Quarles of Northport. The fence was lined with 700 people, lots and lots of Girl Scouts and Brownies. Later, I learned why. A few Negro women waving United States flags. Faces of all ages and types, but all smiling. I shook hands with a part of a fence full, and then we drove to the campus. The white-pillared Southern Mansion serves as the residence of the president of the university for the welcoming ceremony that took place on the balcony. What a superb setting. The house overlooks a spacious quadrangle. There are enormous trees going back to its founding days of 1830, probably. Surrounding it, dignified, red brick, rather Georgian type, stand the older buildings, the very heart of the university. There was a band and a few hundred students. The only sign I saw was a double one which proclaimed, on one end, "We support LBJ on Vietnam," and on the other, "Draft Lady Bird for Governor of Alabama." Dr. Rose introduced me as the university's most famous ex-student, in no wise deserved for my 6 weeks there one summer term, but a mighty pleasant beginning. And then two very fine-looking young people, a young man who is president of the student body for men, and an attractive young woman who is president of the women students. Segregation still exists in that field, evidently. There were flowers and nice words of welcome, the Million Dollar Band playing their school song, and then we went inside to see the high-ceilinged elegance of the old house. It fascinates me. It was built in the 1840s when there were only several dozen students at the university. They planned ahead, those early Alabamians. It reminds me of what Thomas Jefferson said about the White House, something like, "Big enough for two popes and one emperor, planned for the ages." It was one of two buildings to survive the Civil War when everything else was burned. We walked over to the Child Development Center, where Head Start teachers are getting on-the-job training, so to speak, as well as regular students at the university who are preparing to become teachers. The cameramen swarmed with delightful potentials for pictures. A room full of 5-year-olds seated at low tables in tiny chairs, having their lunch or listening to stories. They and I are equally shy with each other. The young teachers were an extraordinarily attractive group of young women. So were most of the young folks I met on the campus. Dr. Rose, it seems, has a contract to train Head Start teachers for not only Alabama, but several adjoining states that have not been so quick to seize federal opportunities in this line. Back at the mansion, we had a glass of sherry and talked about the university. Does he have any of the problems like they have at California? Long hair, way out. Rebellious students? Yes, some. Very little, really. The only thing he's told them they can't do is have a communist speak to them on the campus. One thing they've done is supply more blood for the armed forces in Vietnam than any other university. I supposed he meant according to size, but I was proud of it in any case. The student body was about 12,000, the tuition marvelously low, and there was a president's fund, which enabled him to help through school. Poor but promising students. I was enormously impressed with him. The soft-spoken, able, assured, tough man who kept up the closest kind of a liaison with the federal government to immediately get for his university any programs, grants, or help being offered. In return, makes about 2 trips a month to Washington, he says, working on civil rights business. It was a centerpiece of the most beautiful camellias I've ever seen, in every shade of pink, white, rose, red, some as large as salad plates. Spring is not yet quite beginning in Alabama. There'd been snow just a few days ago. The camellias in the backyard were coming out, and I'd seen a few vagrant jonquils. A nice young woman came to do my hair. I put on my green silk dress, mentally counting the numbers of times, dozens, in which these same newspaper women had seen me in it, and went forth to make my speech, feeling somewhat braver because of the hours Mrs. Provenson and I have put in on it. Dr. Rose escorted me up onto the platform of the large gym. It was rather overwhelmingly full. Alabama women leaders on the main floor, and in the balcony, the women students who had been asked. There was only a sprinkling of Negro faces. And as I looked around for cousins, alas, I saw only one, Patsy's mother, very pretty and dignified in a flowered hat. This auditorium was the one where a famous confrontation had taken place, so I was told, between Governor Wallace and Nicholas Katzenbach. They stared across a chalk line at each other after Wallace's statement that he would stand in the door and block any Negro student. Now there are something between 50 and 200 Negro students. The authorities tell me they are not quite sure how many there are, since there's no little box to check on your entrance papers. I got through the speech rather well, I thought, fighting the battle of glasses all the way, finding myself actually shaking at some points because I was intense about what I was saying, believed it, and wanted them to like it, and wanted somehow my voice to carry enough selling message to get them to like it. I was quite pleased when they began to clap when I mentioned Lister Hill, and once again, though not so much, for John Sparkman. It's always a moment of enormous relief to me when it is over. And this time, I thought, well over. Back at the mansion, there were pictures with the conference leaders. And then I stood in line for nearly 2 hours. There's nothing like a Southern receiving line. We visit. I like it. There were some delightful little vignettes. Woman who confided to me that her name was just as difficult as mine, Sunset. I thought that was a bit Freudian of her parents. The League of Women Voters told me that they had set up poll tax booths in supermarkets and in the lobbies of schools where PTA meetings were being held. You have to go where the people are. What a good service. I was impressed. Ever so many told me how much they liked my speech. I don't know whether it was typical Southern politeness, because I am so often quite openly sure that what I said was mediocre. This time, I chose to believe them and basked in the warmth of approval and friendship. One lady said her husband was Edwina's doctor. They were going to take good care of her. She was going to be all right. Quite a few said they knew Carolyn Johnson or the Patillas. One was a close friend of Elaine's. A nun came down the line holding a single jonquil, which she said, "I swiped this flower for you from the campus." Over and over the most constant repeated rhythm. "We like your beautification program. We're doing this. We're planning that project in our community." And then came the most startling thing of all. Suddenly, a woman in front of me said, "The Lyndon Baines Johnson Library is going to be built on my parents' home." slipped a letter into my hands. The newspaper women had been gathered behind me, taking notes on what people said. I could just feel them scurrying away, like when you throw out a handful of corn in the chicken yard, and all the chickens run to it. In startled amazement, I murmured something, and she handed me a letter and disappeared into the crowd, pursued by my friends of the press. Of all the things we thought might happen in Alabama, this would have been the last one. And then finally, one cute lady leaned over and said, "I've got good news for you. The line is almost over." It had been beautifully handled, and I'd enjoyed every moment. Mrs. Rose took me in the library where her cute little daughter Elizabeth brought me some refreshments. Then, in a few moments, we were off to the airport, but first with a drive around the campus. Dr. Rose explaining to me about the divisions of the university, the medical school in Birmingham, the main campus here, the auxiliary at Huntsville, how well he has his pulse on the future of Alabama. It had been interesting to notice the number of Huntsville women that had come down the line, more than from any other town, I believe. It had been also interesting to meet one lone man whose name was Meadows, who had the position as head of the Board of Education, I gathered, and who is from Lowndes County. He seemed on very good terms with Dr. Rose, and I wonder what kind of terms he's on with Lowndes County. As we drove around, it became more and more apparent to me that Dr. Rose somehow manages to run the university without being too beholden either to the Alabama legislature or appropriations. This is partly solved by the tenacity and intelligence with which he searches out every federal source of aid, or by a board of trustees or regents. The reason for the latter, I discovered, is that back in the 1900s, some trustee had been found making off with school funds. They abolished the system of the governor appointing the trustees. From then on, it's a self-perpetuating body with a term of 12 years, and the trustees choose a successor when someone's term is about to expire, apparently with very good results. And then I found out why there had been so many Girl Scouts and brownies at the airport. One of the ladies told me they had staged a cleanup campaign, particularly on the route that we would travel from the airport to the university. So when I arrived at the airport, I said, "Thank you, thank you, thank you," to dozens and dozens of brownies and Girl Scouts. And it was the most adorable that one there to make me a charming little goodbye speech and present me with flowers. My favorite picture of the day was her giving me a kiss on the cheek. By 5:30, we were airborne, full of stories, relaxed, ready for a drink, and I exhilarated that the day had gone so marvelously. The newspaper women crowded around. They acted as though we had been going into some alien land in Alabama and had expected all sort of dramatic turmoil. As far as I was concerned, it had turned out just as I had expected and wanted. I was at home and happy to be there. I was proud of the caliber of women who attended, the faces that came down the line. And I felt they liked me, so I was expansive and jubilant as we flew home, but tired, not ready as Libby Cater was, to arrive at 10 o'clock, change into dinner clothes, and head for the Potomac Marching Society, the best dancing group in town. We arrived at the White House past 9:30, and I went immediately to find Lyndon. He was in his office, the little one, with Dick Russell, whom we persuaded to come home and have dinner with Lyndon, while I listened to them. It's a near miracle. He looked so well and strong, and last year he was so critically ill. I was in bed by 11, still jubilant with my day's work. There's nothing like hard work well done to make for satisfaction, even a sort of feeling of euphoria. I'm always glad to find Dick Russell with Lyndon. Whatever lack of red-hot enthusiasm he may have for the great society, when the going's rough and Lyndon needs the advice of an old hand, a wise old hand, Dick Russell will usually be there.